Welcome to the China in the World podcast, a series of discussions examining China's foreign policy and shifting engagement with the world. Brought to you by the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing and hosted by Paul Manning.
Welcome back to the China in the World podcast. On today's episode, I'm excited to partner with AmCham Shanghai's China Voices podcast and be interviewed by Kate McGill on the U.S.-China relationship. For our listeners who haven't heard of China Voices podcast before, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app. The show digs into unique aspects of the U.S.-China business relationship and the changing nature of doing business in the world's second-largest economy. It discusses a wide variety of issues, ranging from innovations in China's digital landscape and how companies are adapting to a post-COVID world in China, to in-depth analyses of China's economy and the changing state of the U.S.-China bilateral relationship. During our discussion today, Kate and I discuss the state of the U.S.-China relationship 100 days into the Biden administration. For more in-depth analysis on Biden's first 100 days, please be sure to also check out the Carnegie Endowment's recently published compendium, which includes pieces by myself and other Carnegie scholars around the global network in looking at Biden's first 100 days.
Paul, welcome to China Voices. I'm so excited to have you on the show today on this joint podcast episode to talk about President Biden's first 100 days in office and his China strategy.
Well, Kate, thanks for having me on China Voices. And we're delighted to do it as a joint podcast with the Carnegie Tsinghua's China in the World podcast. So thanks again for the invitation.
Yeah, that's great. So just jumping right in, you know, looking at President Biden's first 100 days, you know, he's really set himself apart from the previous administration in many ways. And when it comes to the China strategy, what are the notable differences that you see between President Biden and former President Trump's approaches to a China strategy?
Well, thanks. It's a great question. And I think I would actually start by answering that by saying, surprisingly, to a certain degree, there's actually been some continuity, important continuity, which is important to note up front. In the first 100 days, it's very clear that President Biden and his foreign policy team have carried forward this framing of China as a strategic competitor, which was launched by the Trump administration. We have seen during Biden's, you know, his foreign policy speech that he gave at the State Department, you know, he called China the United States' most serious competitor. We've heard this in the presidential campaign and the Senate confirmation hearings of key cabinet officials, and also in their interim security strategy, where they talked about China, saying that, you know, China has become rapidly become more assertive, and it's the only competitor potentially capable of combining its economic, diplomatic, military, and technological power to mount a sustained challenge to a stable and open international system. So clearly, that continuity of the framing of China as a strategic competitor is important. Now, having said that, I do think there are some differences. The Biden team, I think, generally shared the Trump administration's overall assessment of China as a strategic competitor, but I think they disagreed with a lot of the way that the Trump administration went about its approach to China and its tactics. And I think the Biden team wants to move away from what they saw as extremely confrontational, almost, you know, confrontation for the sake of confrontation, what appeared to be more ad hoc and a counterproductive approach in many cases. And they want to, you know, try to compete smarter and be more effective in advancing U.S. interests. I think one way to think about it is if you think about the Trump team, three C's: compete, confront, and contain. Maybe the Biden team might be compete, confront, and cooperate. Or another way to think about it is previously we had an approach called engagement with some hedging and balancing. And maybe now we might see from the Biden team more balancing and hedging with some engagement. That may be one way to think about it as well.
So like you said, a more cooperative, engaging approach, which we saw some attempts at engagement in Alaska, which has been one of the biggest U.S.-China events in these first 100 days. The meeting was marked by, you know, some notably negative remarks from both sides, an example of the poor state of U.S.-China relations right now. But there was also talk that the behind closed door meetings were more cordial. To you, what were the biggest takeaways from the summit, and what did it signify about the state of the relationship under the Biden administration?
Well, it was an interesting meeting for sure. And I think it's safe to say that, you know, after 4 years of very little formal official dialogue between the United States and China, you know, the Trump administration really kind of abandoned most of the official dialogue mechanisms, with the exception of the trade, you know, the negotiations over trade and economics that were led by Lighthizer and Mnuchin at Treasury Department. And so, you know, after 4 years of very little formal official dialogue, I think diplomacy between the US and China had gotten pretty rusty. And the Anchorage meeting and the summit made this pretty clear. You know, I think in retrospect, it's always 2020, but maybe they should not have begun the meeting with public remarks, press availability in front of the cameras. When you do things like that, both sides tend to, you know, both audiences in China and the US will focus more on optics of the meeting as opposed to the substance of the meeting. And then, you know, you see the two sides posturing for domestic audiences. Washington and Beijing went into the meeting with very different, even competing narratives. You know, we saw Secretary of State Blinken and National Security Advisor Sullivan. They were putting major emphasis on signaling renewed U.S. self-confidence to dispel the narrative that has emerged in China that the U.S. is in rapid and inevitable decline. On the Chinese side, we heard State Counsel Yang Jiechi and the Foreign Minister Wang Yi, you know, really emphasizing sort of a meeting of equals, where China now is an equal to the United States in many respects. You know, sort of, if you criticize us, the United States, we're going to criticize you. And a lot of criticisms on the Chinese side, in fact, about U.S. domestic policy, and including human rights, and which I thought was very interesting. And, you know, I think the Biden team sort of feels if China wants to talk about human rights, then the Biden team will be more than happy to have that discussion. But the third point I guess I would make is that the meeting also signaled that the narrative of the U.S. and China as systemic rivals has pretty much taken hold in both countries. And for anybody who thought there would be a reset in U.S.-China relations to an earlier era of engagement, I think the Alaska meeting should dispel any notion of that. Both countries look to be building up their leverage, trying to strengthen their positions for future discussions. I think one way to think about it is it's like both sides are setting the table to negotiate in this new framework of strategic competition, to negotiate a new balance of power. And so it seems that both sides are trying to strengthen their position, gain leverage, and prepare themselves what I think will be more of a long-term kind of set of negotiations under this new strategic competition framework.
Mm-hmm. And that phrase, strategic competition, I feel like we're hearing it a growing amount lately. And that was actually what I wanted to talk about next. You know, how more specifically can you build on how we're seeing that strategic competition manifest itself under the Biden administration? You know, what are they doing to bolster American advantage at home when it comes to competing with China?
Well, Kate, that is, I mean, you put your finger on it. That's a big part of it, is shoring up America's strength at home, getting our domestic politics to be more functional and more effective, and shoring up our competitiveness at home. You know, Jake Sullivan, who's the national security advisor over the last 4 years, he was also a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment during his time. And he, you know, the way he put it is, you know, that the United States really should put less focus on trying to slow China down and put more emphasis on trying to run faster ourselves. And I think that is a good way to think about it in terms of foreign policy, a big aspect of this would be to create a foreign policy that works for the middle class back in the United States of America. And this is specifically what Jake worked on in terms of his research while he was at the Carnegie Endowment. Second, I think some of the initial policies that we see demonstrate this focus. You've got the vaccine rollout, which is going extremely well in the United States, the American Rescue Plan, which was passed. Now there's a discussion of this infrastructure plan and President Biden putting this forward. That infrastructure bill also, by the way, includes $50 billion for domestic semiconductor fabrication, which is an increasingly critical flashpoint in the U.S.-China relationship. So Biden is focused on demonstrating that the U.S. is not a country in decline, trying to push back on that narrative that has emerged. And that's important to the extent that it will reduce the probability that Beijing could miscalculate or take actions. If they think that America is in decline and we're distracted with things at home, it's possible that Beijing could take actions that could ultimately result in a prolonged confrontation between the U.S. and China. And I think that's part of what the Biden administration is doing to show, you know, that America can come back and we can get our house in order back in the United States, in addition to working closer with our allies.
And so you mentioned one aspect of that strategy that I wanted to follow up on, because I feel like it's something that we're hearing about on both sides, is both sides wanting to be stronger with their domestic production of semiconductors. Is what you've seen in the infrastructure plan and talk from the Biden administration, does that make you confident that the U.S. can really successfully and effectively bolster their semiconductor production and abilities in the near future?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the traditional kind of infrastructure plan that we think about is, you know, roads and bridges and, you know, these kind of sort of infrastructure, airports and the like. And so the fact that within this infrastructure plan is an effort to bolster American advantage and competitiveness across the board, and even in this particular area of semiconductors, I think tells you that it's a much sort of broader plan that moves beyond just the traditional infrastructure. And, you know, we'll see what happens. You know, the Republicans have come out of the box saying, you know, it's too broad. That's not, you know, it's too expensive and it covers, you know, too much territory and they want it scaled down. So we're going to have to see, you know, what happens in the United States with this infrastructure plan, whether or not the Biden team is able to get it through and whether or not that $50 billion for domestic semiconductor fabrication will survive through the politics of it all.
Yeah, you're right. And now I want to talk also about another hot button phrase that I feel like we hear from the Biden team, which is his multilateral approach to foreign policy and leveraging collective power with U.S. allies to pressure China on everything from trade to human rights. What steps have you seen Biden successfully take so far to secure this front? And do you think he will succeed in combating the legacy of Trump's more unilateral approach to foreign policy?
Well, this is a really important area, Kate, and I'm glad you asked about it. I mean, you know, if we go back, you know, I worked in the 5 years in the White House and I straddled the Bush administration and then went into the Obama administration. And working with allies has been a guiding principle in our Asia policy and in our China policy, certainly since the Bush administration. That was a big part of what the Bush administration wanted to focus on. The Obama administration built on those efforts. Trump departed from it. And now Biden is getting back to it. And I think it's very important. We often say that a good China policy, an effective China policy begins at home in shoring up your strength domestically. Then you move to the allies and your regional partnerships in, you know, shoring up strength and dealing with China. So the Biden team is eager to show China and the world that the U.S. is back. I think they understand, and part of that is working with allies in a more multilateral approach. I think they understand that kind of diplomacy, it's not a light switch. You can't turn it on and turn it off in the Trump administration and just come in the Biden administration, turn it on. It's going to take time, I think, to restore trust and credibility. We also, as we think about how to work multilaterally and with allies, there won't be a monolithic approach. We're going to have to meet allies and partners sort of where they're at. On issues, for example, like human rights, I think we're likely to find more common ground with our European allies. Security issues might be more salient for our Asian allies and partners. And some issues will have no sort of clear dividing line, such as, you know, data regulation. Overall, I think the Biden administration has come out of the gates wanting to be quite strong on this front. It is still early days. They have been consistent in speaking about the importance of international relationships. We saw that President Biden convened the first executive level Quad summit. You saw an important joint statement between the UK, the EU, Canada, and Japan, including sanctions, which condemned China's policies and actions on human rights issues with regard to Xinjiang. And then this coming week, you know, President Biden will host a global climate summit with 40 world leaders. So they are coming out of the box strong on this. I think it will be a very important component, and I think it's the right thing to do.
And so talking about those partners and kind of meeting them where they're at, what role will third party countries, both from, you know, Western democracies and countries in the Asia Pacific, play in determining the trajectory of the bilateral relationship? You know, will countries need to take sides? And, you know, when it comes to choosing a side, what success is China having in courting its own partners and forming its own front?
I think, Kate, that third party countries will play a very important role as we follow this. And that's been very evident in the lead up to and following the Anchorage summit between the US and China. In the lead up to the meeting in Alaska, President Biden, as I mentioned, he met with the Quad leaders. In addition, the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense did meetings in Japan and South Korea with their counterparts, called the 2+2 meetings. Kurt Campbell was also in the press saying that, you know, it's not really going to be possible for us to improve our bilateral relationship with China if they continue to coerce economically Australia and bully Australia. Pretty strong remarks. After the Alaska meeting, we saw the Secretary of State Blinken travel, speak to NATO. President Biden joined the EU foreign ministers meeting, and they emphasized in those meetings the challenges that China poses. On the Chinese side, right after the Alaska meeting, we saw the foreign minister hosting the Russian foreign minister in Guilin. And the two sides agreed during that meeting to work together against sanctions from the U.S. and its allies. Wang Yi also traveled to Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran, the UAE, Bahrain, and Oman right after the Alaska meeting. But I think it's important to think about it in this way. I think third-party countries are not looking to choose sides, so to speak, between the U.S. and China. I mean, they have a deep self-interest, I think, in maintaining positive relations with both Washington and Beijing. And recognizing this, I think we've seen a dramatic shift in the rhetoric from Washington under the Biden administration. The Trump administration, you know, we heard anecdotes of the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor traveling around the world, putting pressure on countries to sort of choose between the U.S. and China. And I think that is not the approach we will see with the Biden administration. And finally, I think China had a bit of a window of opportunity under the Trump administration to strengthen its relations with third-party countries. Because many of, you know, Trump's policies, the American First policies, alienated allies and partners. And so there was an opportunity for China, I think, to take advantage of that. But to be honest, I think Beijing was, I guess, mildly successful is one way to say it. I mean, it was sort of like one step forward and one step back. And you can see that in polling that indicates, you know, a rising sort of anti-China sentiment across the globe in many major countries. And I think, you know, for Beijing, in order to more effectively court partners, it's going to have to really sort of abandoned its wolf warrior diplomacy and rhetoric, assertive actions that we see in the South China Sea, on the Indian border with Taiwan, Hong Kong. You know, those kind of aggressive actions, you know, make it easier for countries to sort of align more closely with the United States. And then finally, the Biden team will be challenged, as I said, to sort of rebuild that trust and confidence of allies and partners that are hedging, you know, against another Trump-like candidate coming forward after 4 years and winning the presidency. We have to convince allies and partners that, you know, the next administration, whoever it is that comes in, will continue to put a priority on allies and partners. And so that'll be an important effort by the Biden team. And we've seen an emphasis on this in the first 100 days.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to have one quick follow-up question. You know, you mentioned that, you know, third-party countries really, they don't want to have to choose sides. And so, especially from DC, they're trying to respond to that sentiment. But what about the smaller Southeast Asian countries that maybe are more reliant on one country or the other for trade and to boost their own economies? Can those smaller nations afford to remain neutral, do you think, moving forward?
You know, a lot of those countries do rely on China in terms of trade, in terms of infrastructure or other economic issues, but they are worried about, you know, over-influence by China or China, you know, putting too much pressure on them. And they want the United States, you know, as at a minimum as a counterbalance, you know, to China in that regard. I think the United States, we have to be very careful that countries in the region don't think of China, you know, when they think of trade and economic benefits to their countries, they don't think only of China. And for security, the United States, I think that would be a sort of a bad deal. The U.S. has to be involved in the trade and the commerce in the region and has to build bilaterally and multilaterally frameworks that show America's commitment to the region in the trade and economic space. You know, it was unfortunate that it didn't work out for the U.S. to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It'll be hard for the Biden administration early on, but I hope as the years go by, we can find a reconsideration of the U.S. joining efforts like the CPTPP, because it's not only important, you know, to show our commitment, but strategically, it's important because it is a multilateral effort to set high standards and principles on important trade and economic issues. So United States, Southeast Asian countries, to your original question, I think they do want the United States there. Again, they're worried about over-influence by China, certainly on the security side, but the U.S. has got to get in the economic and trade game as well.
And now moving back kind of domestically to the U.S. and Biden's formation of his Asia policy team, you know, his team includes several people from the Obama administration, including, you know, Kirk Campbell, Jake Sullivan, but people who seem to be now taking a harder stance against China. To you, what's changed in their mindsets? And then related to that, you know, several posts also remain unfilled, including the U.S. ambassador to China. And I was curious who you thought might fill that post and what it could signal about China's strategy.
So it's a great question. I think one of the things we have to remember is that real frustrations emerged toward China in the United States in the second term of the Obama administration. And those folks were there, right? So Jake Sullivan was part of the administration. You know, if you remember issues around cybersecurity, cyber theft of commercial intellectual property in the billions, issues around China's island building campaign in the South China Sea, the Obama administration's inability to really make progress, important progress on economic and trade issues and negotiations. These frustrations, you know, really grew toward the second half of Obama's time in office. And you'll remember, of course, the pivot to Asia. And that was a lot about China, ultimately. So changes, and I think the reasons for that we have to keep in mind is that there's been quite a bit of changes coming out of China in terms of China's political environment, in terms of their economic strategy and in terms of their international approach. My colleague at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, Dr. Tong Zhao, recently did an interview with On Point. And, you know, he made the point in that interview that President Xi of China has changed China, in his view, more than Donald Trump changed the United States. And changes in leadership, authoritarianism at home, assertiveness abroad, I think has led to the sort of a bipartisan consensus in the U.S. on the challenges that China presents. Both engagement under Obama and confrontation under Trump, you know, if you think about the Obama administration's effort to engage China, President Trump's team was very confrontational, but neither really effectively addressed the growing problems in the relationship. Trump administration, you know, had sort of a punitive approach to economic and technology competition, and that led China to sort of double down on its indigenous innovation. And now they have this dual circulation strategy, which sort of embodies that. And the Biden administration ultimately is trying to devise a more effective strategy that would include, as I said earlier, competing smarter, pushing back on China where it needs to, but working with China also to solve bilateral problems and global problems, and cooperating with China where it is in our common interest to do so. This is not an easy balancing act to do all four of those things together. In terms of the next ambassador, it looks like it will be Nick Burns, who is a longtime Foreign Service officer. He's got quite a bit of experience. He was our ambassador in NATO. He was the number three at the State Department in the Bush administration, working under Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. He worked very closely with China on the P5 plus one Iran issue. So I think he's somebody who understands the importance of working on global issues with China, but working very closely with our allies and partners. And I think he'll be a very good ambassador.
And also related to Biden's team, you know, one of the most significant appointments so far has actually been naming Katherine Tai as U.S. Trade Representative. And she recently said in an interview that the administration is not ready to yank, as she said, the China tariffs.
Right.
What do you make of this? Are the tariffs here to stay indefinitely then?
I saw those comments and I thought they were interesting. I think, you know, the way I think about it is, you know, President Biden would most certainly not, in my view, have initiated the tariffs that we now have in place, but he's also not going to roll them back early on without getting something in return. When you're doing diplomacy and foreign policy, leverage is a very important thing. And so I think this, you know, holding those tariffs for now is a part, I think, of the administration's overall focus on accumulating leverage as it prepares, as I said, for what, you know, what I see as sort of an extensive set of negotiations under this new strategic competition framework. The new USTR, Katherine Tai, she has argued that the tariffs are a legitimate tool for countering China's malign trade practices, but it seems to be focused mainly on enforcing existing phase one trade deal. I don't think we're going to see this administration put new tariffs into place. You know, the Trump administration also was very focused on the trade deficit between the U.S. and China as an indicator for the health of the bilateral trade relationship. I think the Biden team is, you know, they have their concerns about China's mercantilistic trade approach, but there will be a less focus on trade deficit. And I think more emphasis on important structural issues and also on, you know, making sure, you know, that our American middle class at home is not disadvantaged by some of China's economic practices. The USTR, Katherine Tai said in her testimony to the Senate Finance Committee, the U.S. has to pursue trade policies that advance the interest of all Americans, policies that recognize that people are workers and wage earners, not just consumers. And so where Trump and Lighthizer deeply skeptical of the international economic system, I think President Biden and Katherine Tai, now head of USTR, I think both of them believe the institutions like the WTO should be reformed rather than abandoned. And I think that will be a big difference by the Biden team.
And so you mentioned this word leverage, which I feel like is also related to use of the entity list by the U.S. You know, earlier this month, the Biden administration added 7 more Chinese tech companies to the entity list, citing their ties to the Chinese military. What's your take on Biden's use of the blacklist as a pressure strategy? And do you see his team using the list in the same way the Trump administration did?
Well, that's a great question. I think, you know, clearly, as I've indicated, the Trump team was not the first team to identify the growing connection between technology linkages and important national security considerations. As I said before, the frustrations that we saw toward the end of the Obama administration around cybersecurity, this intellectual property loss, which ranged in the hundreds of billions of dollars, the Obama team put in place executive order in 2015, which authorized sanctions in response to Chinese cyber attacks. The dual use military civil research centers put on the entity list in 2015 as part of the National University of Defense Technology, or the Chinese National University of Defense Technology, and the National Supercomputing Center in Tianjin. So the Biden administration recognizes the problem, but I do think that it will use different tactics than the Trump administration. What you often hear is a concept of a tall fence and small yards, more clearly defined national security risks, where we're balancing American national security interests with our commercial and economic interests, and trying to find a better balance and defining a clear set of strategic dual-use technologies that require national security oversight, but also allowing for the positive-sum trade to take place in other domains. And I think by not completely cutting off U.S. tech companies from their buyers in China, that'll allow U.S. companies to remain competitive and to invest their profits in research and development down the line. I think multilateralism will play a big part of this. Without a concerted effort to address, you know, common concerns around China with our partners and allies, I think that, you know, punitive export control, investment screenings could hurt U.S. industry while at the same time failing to prevent China from acquiring strategic technology. So there's an important balance here to be found. And I think that the Biden team wants to try to do it smarter than the Trump team did, and to be more effective in maintaining that balance between national security and our own commercial and economic interests.
We've talked a lot in this interview about areas of competition between the U.S. and China, but I wanted to pivot to talk about some areas of possible cooperation, particularly on climate change. You know, just a few days ago, John Kerry was here in China discussing climate change cooperation. What kind of collaboration between the U.S. and China on climate change do you think is truly possible? And what evidence have we seen to support this?
Yeah, I think this is going to be an important area to focus on. Clearly, President Biden takes climate change, you know, quite seriously, as does his administration. He acknowledges this is a global issue and there are high stakes for all countries, not just the United States. And this, you know, we have to say right up front, what a massive shift that is from what we saw over 4 years of the Trump administration. So in that context, you know, China and the U.S., the two largest economies and the two largest emitters of greenhouse gases, they have a pretty significant responsibility to collaborate where it's possible to do so. The Biden team has been pretty clear that it does not want to, you know, given that this is a global issue, given that there are high stakes for all countries, not just the U.S., this should not be an issue where, you know, we engage in issue trading. You know, we're sort of you're not going to, you know, pull our punches with China and in certain areas to sort of garner their cooperation in climate change. This is a global issue and China should want to cooperate based on its own merit, based on the merits of the issue. So I think this is going to be, as we've seen already, it's been a bit of a sticking point because, you know, the Chinese side says, well, that's not the way diplomacy works. But I think the U.S. has a different view. we saw, as you said, special climate envoy John Kerry traveled to Shanghai. Not any particularly new agreements, so to speak, but, you know, both sides did agree on the importance of cooperation on this issue and to maintaining prior multilateral agreements. I think it's an important step in the right direction, given, you know, the tense political dynamics between the U.S. and China that we have seen. And, you know, the joint statement that they released after the meeting also talked about both countries' commitment to taking enhanced climate actions that raise ambitions in the 2020s in the context of the Paris Agreement. So, you know, there was some good discussions, and hopefully the two sides can build on that. And of course, as I mentioned before, President Biden will have his summit this soon on climate with 40 other heads of state. So it's an issue to follow, and I hope it's one that the U.S. and China can find their way to cooperate on.
Yeah, certainly, certainly so, and certainly something to watch. And my final question, you know, looking at closing out these first 100 days, when you look at the Biden administration's China strategy as a whole, do you feel like it's been well articulated thus far? And then looking forward, you know, where do you expect it to go over the course of the first term?
Oh, that's a great question. I think, you know, many have commented that the Biden administration, you know, seems to be rolling out its China policy somewhat slowly. My own view is, you know, that's pretty understandable, you know, given that, you know, policy reviews are taking place right now within the administration. You know, while some of the cabinet secretaries are in place, you know, a lot of the assistant secretaries and deputy assistant secretaries are not in place yet. We don't have our ambassador in Beijing just yet. So, you know, those officials will be very, very important in terms of, you know, determining, formulating the policy and getting approval at the highest level. So that's going to take some time. And as I said, the administration is focused on building up leverage through, you know, rebuilding domestically, reviving our alliances and partnerships, and reasserting U.S. leadership abroad. And this will frankly take a little time. So while some people think it's that the Biden team has been slow to roll out its China policy, I, on the other hand, I think I understand why that is. You know, I have been a little bit surprised, I would say, by how constrained the Biden team seems to feel by U.S. domestic politics with regard to the China issue. You know, we've seen a real hesitancy to do much positive toward China or to roll back Trump policies. But again, I think that's part of sort of maintaining leverage. But the Biden team will, you know, have to figure out how to balance domestic partisanship, how to balance that, you know, those domestic pressures with the need over time to roll back some of the self-defeating and counterproductive policies and executive orders that the Trump administration put out. And if they're going to distinguish their policy from the Trump administration, they're going to have to show how they're competing smarter and how they're being more effective in protecting and advancing U.S. interests. I suspect we'll begin to see that over time, but we haven't seen a lot of that in the early days. But again, I think a lot of that is understandable. On the other side of the Pacific, let me just close out my answer by saying that I've been surprised by Beijing's inability to recognize that there is blame on both sides for the downturn in the U.S.-China relationship. Any improvement in the U.S.-China relationship will be dependent not just on the Biden administration, but also by the Chinese leadership. And China has to step up and demonstrate that it recognizes it has agency in the U.S.-China relationship. You know, China seems to want a reset in the relationship to something more stable and says it wants to improve the bilateral relationship. But I have seen very little in terms of what Beijing is offering to do that. Very little in terms of concrete changes that China is willing to make. And at the end of the day, it takes two hands to clap. And right now, I haven't seen a very self-reflective posture by China. And it will be important for China to step up and show some flexibility and some willingness to take steps to put the relationship on better footing. It cannot only be the Biden team that does that.
And you're right, there will be plenty to watch on both sides to see how things take shape in the coming weeks, months, and really years. Well, Paul, thank you so much for coming on the show today. This has been a really fascinating and enlightening conversation, taking stock of Biden's first 100 days.
Kate, thanks again for having me on China Voices. I enjoyed your great questions and talking to you about this important relationship. And again, so happy we can do this as a joint podcast with our China in the World.
Thank you for listening to the China in the World podcast. For more episodes and research, please go to carnegiechinghua.org. This episode was produced by Lucas Chayan with assistance from Madison Reed, Luke Incarnation, Li Chi Xu, John Ferguson, and Sophia Rosso.